Husker Doc Talk Podcast, 2016, Episode 14. Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Husker Doc Talk Podcast presented by the Remington Trophy. I'm Travis Justice, joined by former Husker All-American, all-around nice guy, Dr. Rob Zavisky. What's up, Doc?
How are you doing?
You know, I'm good. I'm very, very good. And I'm anxious to ask you a couple questions before we actually get started with today's podcast.
Okay.
Because you...
Would that be actually starting the podcast?
Well, no, because a lot of people think we don't start the podcast till we start talking about the Huskers.
Gotcha.
Okay? So I think that's the
or
way the people...
Beer.
Or beer. And beer is coming real soon. But you just got back from New Orleans, where you have now seen my daughter more than I've seen my daughter in the last year. How was my kid?
She's doing great. So, yeah, we hung out, went to dinner, ate Cajun food.
Now, you went to Giacomo's, which, by the way, is a great place to eat. You had the alligator cheesecake.
It is. It's kind of a hole in the wall, which yeah. is, that's the kind of place I like when it comes to food.
So, when you got the alligator cheesecake, what were you thinking?
You know, I wasn't sure. You know, your daughter, Abby, did tell us that it's kind of more of like a...
appetizer.
It's savory.
Yes.
It's more of a dinner item.
Yes.
And you say cheesecake, it's kind of like a heavy cream and egg-based
yes.
dish. Do you know what it is? It's like a cheesy alligator and shrimp quiche.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
It's kind of how to think about it, except way more spicy and really, really good.
And not really healthy for you.
No, not at all.
Now, you happen to be, I don't know if you went down there. Po' Boy Fest was going on when you were down there as well.
It was that Sunday, and there was a couple of museums we wanted to hit when we were down there, and so we ended up not hitting Po' Boy Fest, although the fried green tomato Po' Boy... I can't remember what restaurant had it, but it sounds really good.
So you had before we move on, did you hit the World War II Museum?
I did, but you know what? That's one of those places where, talk about an expansive museum.
Yes.
Which was started by Stephen Ambrose, I believe.
Yeah, well, and then Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg did the movie that opens it up. Did you watch the movie?
We did not, because we had about 2 hours to go through there, and that would have essentially killed nearly half that time.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to see as much of it as we can. It's one of those places, and you had told me this. He said, if you really want to kind of experience it, you kind of got to give it kind of bare bones minimum, about a full day.
You know, I know a lot of Husker fans like to go to Florida. They like to go to California, Arizona, and they don't think about vacationing to New Orleans. And I know New Orleans gets a bad rap.
You don't go there for beaches.
You don't go there for beaches, but there's if you can go there for culture.
Yeah, you can. There's a ton to do.
Yes.
Insanely good museums. There's an art museum, the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, which absolutely outstanding museum. Some of the collections they had were incredible. But there's some great art museums. There's some awesome history museums. You mentioned the World War II. There's a Civil War museum there. The cemeteries are incredible. We did a cemetery tour.
Did you?
We did St. Louis Cemetery number 1, which is where Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen, is buried. Homer Plessy, civil rights activist from the late 1800s, Plessy versus Ferguson, which was basically kind of the forerunner to Brown versus Board of
That's
Education.
Right.
It wasn't an education-based civil rights trial, but it was one of the first ones that established the whole separate but equal ideal, which then got upheld in Brown versus Board of Education, then subsequently was shot down after that. But he's buried there. Nicolas Cage actually yet to be occupied, but Nicolas Cage actually has a tomb there.
So that's where he's going to get buried. Interesting.
Well,
you're not really buried. You're raised.
Yeah, he may not, but he has a tomb there. The rumor is supposedly he bought a property in New Orleans,
nice.
like this restored antebellum mansion, only to discover that it was annoyingly haunted. And so he went and supposedly he consulted with seances, priests, and some voodoo practitioners, and they all said, hey, according to the messages we're getting, you need to go get a tomb in St. Louis Cemetery, and
that's what he did. And I bet it wasn't cheap either.
No, and that was the thing, is that what ended up happening is that he ended up having to shell out literally thousands upon thousands of dollars to buy the tomb, to renovate it. The Catholic Archdiocese down there that has a number of requirements for quote-unquote outside people to come in and be able to purchase a tomb. And to do that, you have to have some connection to somebody already buried there. Well, it turns out there's actually members of the Coppola family.
Is that right?
Who have a huge, huge Italian-style ornate tomb there with supposedly 80-some members of the Coppola family are buried there. Well, it turns out Nicolas Cage is
related in some way.
He's like a nephew, great-nephew, something like that, to the Coppola family. And so apparently he was able to actually, he had to hire genealogists to do this huge genealogy search and found out that he's distantly related to a number of people buried in this tomb in the particular cemetery, and that's what opened the door for him to get it. But anyway, if you like history, cemeteries, I'm a huge history nerd, and cemeteries are basically, it's archival history.
And the point of it is, there's more to New Orleans than Bourbon Street, and there's culture, there's food, there's history. And
if you're a foodie, it's an absolute foodie paradise.
Hey, the Husker Doc Talk podcast is presented by the Remington Trophy. The Remington Trophy is presented annually to the nation's top center, named after former Husker great Dave Remington. The Remington Trophy Banquet will take place on January 14th, 2017 at the Rococo Theater in Lincoln. This year's Ford Legends Award winner is Carl Mack. He played in the NFL for 13 seasons, also an assistant coach for many, many years. He's retired and living in Lincoln now. His daughter is a former Husker swimmer, also lives in Lincoln with her husband and kids. Still to be announced this year's featured speaker, but it's always a good one. The Remington Trophy presentation benefits the Boomer Esiason Foundation, where Dave is the president. Cystic fibrosis is a chronic disease that affects the lungs and digestive system of about 30,000 children and adults in the United States and 70,000 worldwide. For more on how you can help fight cystic fibrosis and those who have it, visit esiason.org. Coming up a little bit later on, the Remington Trophy watch list spotlight. Also, we want to welcome to the Husker Doc Talk podcast this year, Husker Hounds. It's the best place to buy Nebraska gifts and officially licensed apparel. Halloween is sneaking up on us, so if you want those cheerleader outfits or those Husker football outfits for the kiddos, go to Husker Hounds in one of its three locations in the Omaha area. Also visit them at huskerhounds.com. And a big thank you to huskermax.com for sharing the Husker Doc Talk podcast. For up-to-date Husker news, visit huskermax.com. What are we drinking this week, Rob? It wouldn't be a Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy without beer. And what are we drinking?
Well, you know, a little something different. This is from Off Color Brewing out of Chicago, which I think this might be only the second time I've drank their beer, but they've got a number of different styles of beer. Smaller brewery out of Chicago, rapidly growing in popularity. You're probably going to start seeing their stuff a lot of different places.
People are going to think like we're weird because we're drinking beer with coriander in it.
You know, it kind of depends on the style of beer. This would be a Gose style. Goza style, G-O-S-E. And that's how I was told it's pronounced. Okay. I could be wrong on that, but it's usually kind of occasionally like a light. It's a beer that oftentimes has almost a salt additive that gives it almost kind of a tartness to it. So it's not a true sour, but if you like sours, you'll really like this style of beer. We did one earlier, Sierra Nevada's. They had Otra Vase? Is again same kind of thing. Which oftentimes they have occasionally. It's not even a sweetener. Almost it's usually actually something for the yeast to ferment with. But this one, it does have a little coriander in it. It is not overpowering. I know a lot of people. There's a lot of wheat beers out there that kind of get loaded up on the coriander, and you drink them, and that coriander can kind of smack you in the face a little bit. It's not like that.
Yeah, this is pretty good. I like it.
Yeah, it's a very nice light beer. Has kind of a little bit of a tartness to it, but not as much as a true sour.
So let's get to, because a lot of people are like, now, okay, you've talked about New Orleans, you talked about, let's talk about the goddamn Huskers. It's that time.
Which, if you were watching the game, I'm sure there was a lot of that going on.
Well, we're not even going to talk about Purdue this week. I don't even want to talk about Purdue because
I think we got it.
Well, but I think you mix it in with how we're going to talk, because they're getting ready for Wisconsin now. I mean, this is the game that everybody's been waiting for. This is where, you know, if you've picked on Nebraska's schedule, fine.
Did you follow the Twitter feed at all this weekend?
No, because I was working on a fundraiser where we raised money for cancer.
I was tweeting up a storm, and all I got was people like, I want to hear your take on the O-line.
Okay, well, but we can get to that because let's start with Wisconsin's defense against Nebraska's offense, specifically O-line, because Nebraska's been able to control clock and really get to the fourth quarter, dominate the line of scrimmage.
You know, except for this past weekend.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. So you're going against is one of the better defenses in the country, for sure the Big Ten.
It is. I mean, this is a tough, tough defense they got. You know, it's interesting, though, because I know there's a lot of these kind of little glimmers of hope. Like Wisconsin had this monstrous 340-pound nose tackle, which I don't say this about a lot of guys. It was like having a 12th defender sitting in the middle of the field. The guy just talked about gumming up a couple of blockers every single play. He's out there. There's starting middle linebacker, team leader in tackles. He's out for the game. So there is some of these guys that have kind of really keyed that defense are out. Now, the thing is that that was a defense that played well across the board. It played great. You hear this phrase, they played great team defense. It was almost the scheme as much as it is the players. And that's the thing where having a couple of these guys out, yeah, it's going to provide some glimmers of hope for Nebraska. Is it going to completely change the face of Wisconsin's defense? And no, it's not. This is still an incredibly, incredibly good defense. Everybody's had trouble moving the ball.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking, their only two losses are to Michigan and Ohio State. And they lost to both of those teams by 7 points. And Michigan only put 14 up on them. And to hold Michigan to 14 is saying something.
Yeah, it is the way they've been scoring points. And you know, when Ohio State has tools, after that Penn State game, I'm kind of fearing that Urban's been letting
Hold on. Did they poke the bear? Was the worst thing to happen to Nebraska moving forward was Ohio State getting beat? Is it like poking the bear?
I think it really is, because I think, again, it forces Urban Meyer to reevaluate things. And whenever that guy reevaluates things, bad things happen.
To other teams. Yes.
And I think that's going to happen again with this. I'm convinced Tim Beck called plays for the better part of last season up through the Michigan State game. I think after the Michigan State game, Tim Beck was no longer calling plays, because the offense for Ohio State their last two games of the season, it was a completely, completely different complexion. The style of offense they ran, the play calling, it was just so completely and utterly different after that Michigan State game. Their offense has been almost a smidge pedestrian. Now, they've lost some great players. I mean, you look at a guy like Ezekiel Elliott, who's essentially leading the NFL in rushing as a rookie. They've lost some key players. They lost some very good offensive linemen off of last year's team. They've still, I mean, God, talk about a team that just reloads. They've still got just an immense volume of talent on that team, and they've kind of almost gotten a little bit stale. The next couple of weeks, including the Nebraska game, I think you're going to see a little bit of a different Ohio State team.
But let's jump back to Wisconsin, because that's who the Huskers play this week. Wisconsin didn't dominate Iowa by any means, but, well, I should say, score-wise, they didn't dominate. That's a little deceiving, because turnovers, penalties, missed opportunities.
They kind of Nebraska to win over Iowa.
They really did. They did. And, I mean, I think Wisconsin is better than what they showed against Iowa.
Well, and here's the other thing, too. I don't think Wisconsin's offense is remotely as good as their defense.
No, I would totally agree with you.
Their defense is absolutely brutal. Now, their best offensive day, I'd have to go double check, but I believe Wisconsin's best offensive day was against Michigan State. And Michigan,
which has been the case for a lot of teams
Michigan,
this year.
Yeah, Michigan State is just absolutely reeling. They are not a good team this year. And so I don't know if that's saying much. I think they put up, 30 against Michigan State. But that's a team that just is not playing good defense. Michigan State is in the midst of a massive rebuilding project this year. And so they're just not very good. So I think that's kind of the lone outlier, but it was against arguably one of the worst teams that Wisconsin has played thus far.
Well, they put up 54 against Akron. That doesn't count.
That doesn't count.
They put up 30 against Michigan State, and they put up 23 against Ohio State. They put up 17 against. Yeah, I mean,
how much did they put up against Georgia State?
Georgia State, they put up 23.
23. So, hey, Georgia State, they're right there with Ohio State.
But they're going to win ugly. They're going to pound the ball at you. They're going to try to control the clock. I mean, there are some similarities here.
Yeah, I mean, they play their style. And yes. I think if they stick to their style, don't have any turnovers. Their defense, if they play well and if Nebraska's not perfect, their defense could just gut us. Now, here's kind of the wild card in all of this is the shape of Nebraska's offensive line. I mean, talk about a unit that's just been running on fumes. And I had a lot of people who were tweeting during the game about how horrible Nebraska's offensive line was looking, how the old line was getting gashed. It was like a sieve, run plays, pass plays, guys just going ripping through there. And it was, but the thing that everybody stops, you got to stop and think about is guys like Sam Hahn and Whitaker. These were guys who probably were going to get almost no playing time this year if everybody stayed healthy. These were guys who would have been second, third teamers if everybody had stayed healthy. And right now you've got Gates nursing an ankle injury. You've got Farmer coming back from an injury. You've got Gerald Foster on the bench, David Neville nursing injuries. The one spot where a guy's not completely just shredded from injuries would maybe be Dylan Utter at center. And now that we've kind of gotten into, I thought he played capably.
And you weren't sold on him when the year started.
No, I wasn't. And a lot of it was, here's the thing. I will say this. The kid's a gamer. You're not going to find anybody else who goes out there, bleeds Husker red, and fights tooth and nail for everything. The guy does, and I've got a lot of respect for that. He's also like 6'2", 282 pounds. And going against the guys that Nebraska's been going against the last few weeks, at some point, the laws of physics take over, and if you got a D tackle who's 6'3", 6'4", a nose guard who's 6'3", 6'4", 317 pounds, and can bench press small automobiles, a guy like Utter is going to get beat. And I think we're kind of past the point where we say, hey, well, let's throw. Honestly, I thought we'd see Decker at this point in the season, I'm not sure why. I'm really starting to wonder now if it's kind of a case of, has there been an academic issue? Is he in the coach's doghouse for some reason? By all accounts, he's a very bright guy. However, it's not like Mike Riley's offense or Danny Langsdorf's offense is this quarter-inch thick notebook. I mean, everybody's basically said it's a freaking telephone book. It's huge. Maybe Decker just doesn't have a completely comfortable grasp of that playbook yet, to the extent that they're comfortable putting him in and leaving him in there. I can't help but think from a physical standpoint, you've got a guy who's in his second year, was just a physical monster coming out of high school. I mean, the guy was dominating up at Omaha North. He's got another year of development under his belt, almost 2 years now at this point, two seasons now at this point. Physically, I can't see him not being able to hold his own in the Big Ten Conference. I'm thinking back to when guys like myself, Brendan Stye, Zach Wiegert, Aaron Graham, when we were redshirt freshmen, we were starting games, playing games against what at that time was a very solid conference nationally. Big Eight, Nebraska, K-State, Oklahoma,
even
Oklahoma
Kansas
State,
at that
Colorado,
time.
Kansas, Gilbert Brown, yeah. Dana Stubblefield went on to become Pro Bowlers in the NFL. We could physically hold our own in the Big Eight Conference as redshirt freshmen. I can't see, from a physical standpoint, Decker being able to hold his own. So there's got to be some other reason we haven't seen him play. But I think from a pure physical standpoint, Utter's had problems being a dominant center in the Big Ten Conference. And it's shown. I mean, guys are getting past him. And that's a position where you need a dominant ball player.
So Nebraska's banged up. Wisconsin's banged up. I think it's safe to say the winner of this game, the winner of this game has the inside track to the West Championship. If Wisconsin really, if the winner of this game wins the West, I have a hard time seeing how that does not happen.
It does. I mean, there's some weird schedule things going on where, let's say Nebraska lose, like let's say Northwestern wins out, but Nebraska beats Wisconsin, loses to Ohio State, and then gets like a fluky loss in there.
To Iowa.
Iowa, they have like a big letdown game against Minnesota for Maryland, for instance, and ends up with two losses. Freaking Northwestern could actually win the
West. But I don't think Northwestern wins out.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen either. But yeah, whoever wins this one is definitely in the driver's seat.
But actually, I think Nebraska still sits better because Wisconsin already has two losses.
Yeah.
So if Wisconsin were to trip up, which probably would only happen at Northwestern.
Well, if Nebraska loses to Wisconsin, and let's say Nebraska, and maybe Ohio State's not as good as everybody thinks. Let's say we sneak one out in Columbus. Highly unlikely. But let's say we do, and then wins out the rest of the way. Nebraska actually still wins the West.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of odd in that sense that we could lose to Wisconsin, which is probably the better team, but just it was the schedule. It was the way the schedule worked out. I don't see us losing to Wisconsin. I don't see us losing to Wisconsin and then beating Ohio State in Columbus when Ohio State beat Wisconsin in Camp Randall. I mean, it's the advantage that Wisconsin has just by being in Camp Randall. I honestly think that is the toughest place to go into and play a game in the Big Ten.
So you look at the statistics, and you know Wisconsin's not going to beat with the pass. They're efficient, they're effective, but they're not going to beat you with the pass.
No, they're
running for $1.73 a game.
Yeah, I think if Nebraska actually can get their passing game going. If Tommy plays his game, doesn't force it, doesn't turn it over, plays smart, isn't thrown off of his back foot, God, it'd be nice to have Westerkamp and Seathan Carter, but that's hurt. That's hurt them hugely. But if Armstrong and Nebraska can find a way to I hate saying this, can find a way to pass the ball against Wisconsin, Nebraska's got they've got a puncher's chance.
So does the pass game open up the rush for Nebraska, or does the rush game open up the pass?
Neither. I think Nebraska's just got to be able to pass flat out because I'm having such a hard time. Every time I look at Wisconsin's defense, I'm having a really hard time figuring out how they're going to be able to run the ball against these guys. I think it's going to be a pretty ugly run game.
So right now, you look at it, and Wisconsin has, per game, a 9-minute average in their favor of time of possession. And that defense is holding teams to 24.72% on third down conversion.
Which is awesome.
That is stingy, man.
Which, and again, you know, you mentioned that Iowa game. If you look at the statistics from that Iowa game, time of possession, first downs, things of that nature, Wisconsin just utterly dominated that game. I hate bagging on.
No, they
Hawkins,
did. No, they
but
did.
They did.
I mean, I'm a real. It
wasn't as close as the score looked. Like I saw the score.
Yeah,
I did not watch any of the game. I did a statistical breakdown, but I did not watch the game. But when I saw the score, the first thought that went through my head was like, "Oh, holy crap! We've got a chance." I mean, Iowa was a touchdown and a 2-point conversion from tying this bad boy up, and then you go and look at the statistics and realize, oh no, they weren't. No, it wasn't close.
Well, it wasn't close, and it's I mean, Wisconsin I thought was that much better. So you look at time, but is this one of those games maybe similar to what we've seen in the past? Because Nebraska's defense is pretty stout. I think it is.
And that's kind of the dark horse, is that Nebraska's defense has played very good football this year. I saw a good statistic where, and I think it was actually one that Mike Riley pointed out, was that I think in the first three or four drives against Purdue, Nebraska's defense gave up, I think it was 190-some yards. I think it was 195 yards in the first four drives of the Purdue game. In the subsequent nine drives, I think Purdue had 13 possessions. In the subsequent nine drives, Nebraska's defense only gave up another, it was like 160 some yards.
So they
clamped down, and you know, Purdue scored 14 points, which I think it looked, Nebraska's defense looked worse because the offense wasn't performing at all. But in hindsight, Nebraska's defense did a masterful job in that game against a kid that the quarterback for Purdue, B-L-O-U-G-H, but the guy's gashed Nebraska 2 years in a row. He's only a sophomore this year, and the kid plays the kid's a gamer. He's a very good football player, but against a very good quarterback, a solid running back, in a team that I think was... This was kind of, I think, Purdue's last gasp game. Yeah. They were pulling out all the stops.
Yeah, you might as well.
Onside kicks and fake punts and everything else. This was just one of those games that I think in the situation, this was a legitimate. It was another trap kind of game for Nebraska. I thought Nebraska's defense played well, and that's, like I said, that's going to be kind of the dark horse for Nebraska's. If Nebraska could keep this, could turn this into sort of a 7-7, 10-10 game late in the game, then I think Nebraska's got a very solid chance. They're one of those teams that if you got to say, okay, it's late in the game, it's a tied game, we need some team to chuck the ball 40 yards downfield on a pass and have a receiver make a play. Nebraska's the team that has the guys who can do that. Wisconsin doesn't.
Well, and so I think you and I are in agreement that this is going to be a defensive battle, which means it could come down to what Coach Osborne always used to love to talk about with special teams or penalties or turnovers.
Yeah, the mistake. I would say Nebraska's the team that, well, then we're screwed because if somebody's going to shoot themselves in the foot, it's going to be Nebraska. Wisconsin has decidedly not been immune to that this year.
Yeah.
So they've had their share of mistakes that have really cost them this season.
I say that really cost them.
They're the only two lost top 10 teams.
Now, last year it's a close game, but you know, Wisconsin's won three straight in the series. But every time, especially since they joined the Big Ten, Nebraska goes to Wisconsin, and it's not a pretty game.
And it's been ugly. Now, and the other thing is, too, these are two vastly different teams from last year. I think last year both Nebraska and Wisconsin, they were going into new coaches, coaching changes, new system. Well, I say new system. It's like Wisconsin's offense hasn't changed since 1992. But they've
– True.
It's pretty true. They've but you've got a new coach. You've got, I'm sure, new terminology, the way they do things, the style of coaching. I think both last year Wisconsin and Nebraska were kind of weathering some changes, which kind of gave Nebraska at least a little bit of a chance in that game last year. This year, Wisconsin seems very comfortable with Paul Christ and his coaching staff. They seem very comfortable with the decision to hire him, to bring him back to Madison, and with the direction they're going. I think they are very happy with where they're at, who's in charge, and what they're doing. And when I say that, I'm talking about the players. I'm talking about Wisconsin's football players.
But Nebraska's got buy-in with Mike Riley
And I think now they do. I think last year in that Wisconsin game, Nebraska's players had not had that yet. I mean, we've talked about it before. There's this the mythical meeting that took place after the Iowa game, and Nebraska's 8-0 since then. And that was where it seemed like everybody kind of started to finally buy in. I think this is the same. This is a different Nebraska team than what played in Lincoln last year. You put them on the road and you put them in Camp Randall. I don't know how much that helps Nebraska having that buy-in, but I think these guys do buy in. The bigger issue for me, though, constantly, it's going to come down to injuries, the lack of depth, not having Westerkamp or Seathan Carter, not having some key guys on the offensive line, not having the depth on the offensive line, having guys forced to not play injured, but guys forced to play hurt because of that lack of depth. That's what worries me more than anything. If we were going in there with a reasonably healthy, nobody's perfectly healthy by the eighth game of the season, but if you had a reasonably healthy offensive line, if Gerald Foster had never torn his knee up, if Tommy Armstrong wasn't nursing a sore ankle, if Westerkamp and Seathan Carter weren't out, I'd have a lot more faith in us going up there than I do now. Do I think we've got a chance? Yeah, I definitely do think we have a chance. Do I think we've got a reasonable chance? I think we have a very reasonable chance of coming out of there with a win if they can limit turnovers, limit mistakes, and the defense plays a very solid game. I think Nebraska could do very well in this one.
This week's Remington Trophy Watchlist Spotlight shines on Frank Ragnow from the University of Arkansas. Ragnow was the SEC Offensive Lineman of the Week back in September. Here's a guy who's probably about a year away from really making a huge name for himself. He's 6'5", 319-pound junior. He's a guy who started all 13 games at right guard as a sophomore. He played center in 9 games as a freshman. But he's by Phil Steele, I think, ranked him the 14th best offensive lineman or center in the country.
14th men's center.
Yeah, so I mean, here's a guy, you start looking at guys who are on that watch list but could also be a year away, and he's one of them.
And he's one of these guys, I think we're going to see him next year. This is one of those guys that's going to be a top five guy next year, unless he gets a wild hair and decides to go into the NFL draft. Could he do that? Yeah, I think he's got all of the tools. He's got some versatility. You've seen him play, spend a season as a starting guard. Now he's starting at center. Physically, the guy's a beast. I mean, he's another one of these 6'5", 315-pound centers. I mean, he's built almost like a medium-sized offensive tackle. But it'll be interesting to see. The fact that he's got that versatility, but I think he's kind of a center at heart. You saw him play at center mostly as a freshman. I think it was more of a necessity move that he played at guard last year and then back to center this year. And so give him another year. I think he's one of those guys that kind of needs to get a full year starting at center under his belt, which he's getting this year. And then next year, this is a guy who I think really could be a top five guy next year. Plus, he's got that name Ragnow, which basically it's like a Viking name. It's like I want to see him come out with a freaking shield and battle axe for every game.
So, Rob, I want to talk about two of your old teams, the Huskers and the Giants.
Okay.
The day we record this, which is Tuesday, Josh Brown has released a statement apologizing and saying he's taking measures to get help for his alleged domestic abuse and wants to be the voice of change, not a statistic. Here's his statement. It's important to share that I've never struck my wife. I never would, Brown said in a statement to ESPN's Adam Schefter. Abuses take place in many forms and is not a gray area. Through the past several years, I've worked to identify and rectify my own behaviors. The road to rehabilitation is a journey and a constant modification of a way of life. My journey will continue forever as a person determined to leave a positive legacy. I embrace the opportunities to show and speak about what has helped me be that man. In the interim, I am cooperating with the Giants, the National Football League. Thank you to everyone who has supported me. I will not let you down. That's from Josh Brown. I was shocked, actually. I've known Josh since he was a player, and he was charismatic, great. You know, when media wants to talk to a kicker, you know he's a pretty good soundbite. And media always wanted to talk to Josh. But two things. A, listen, I come from an abusive family. My father was abusive to my mother. I watched domestic violence and abuse, serious domestic abuse, most of my life. So I don't have much sympathy for guys, even when they apologize. But you know, I look at the way it was handled. A couple different things. Hey, Josh Brown, you're an ass. Okay, I'm going to say that. You're an ass for doing it. But I hope you do get help. But I also look at the way the NFL handled this, and I don't like the way the NFL handled it either. It's like they punish him, but all they find is it's like Ray Rice. Well, we're going to find out something more, so we're going to change the whole game on you. It's just a weird. The NFL doesn't not know what it wants to do with domestic violence. It doesn't.
It's not, but I think part of the problem is, too, is that there's a degree of gray area, not in domestic abuse.
Because it comes in verbal, it comes in...
It does, but well, and I guess what I mean by that is the gray area comes in from a legal standpoint. And if you have a guy who, kind of historically, the way things have always been dealt with, college coaches, NFL coaches... It's always been, well, we're going to let the legal process play out and then base a decision on that. And a lot of it kind of goes back to the whole notion of innocent until proven guilty. Now, if you've got a guy who, to my understanding, there's actually no ongoing criminal investigation.
No.
Here, I ask that as kind of a question because, to my understanding, there's not. And so that's where there is a gray area. So you've got a guy into which there is no actual criminal charges, but who is now probably, I could be wrong. I bet we never see Josh Brown in the NFL.
No, again. But he's on the commissioner's list or a suspension list. You're right. I think he's done.
No, but nobody's going to sign this because nobody wants to touch this stuff.
I mean, Ray Rice has done everything humanly possible to apologize. He's been a voice of reason, you know, somebody who's admitted.
His girlfriend, now wife, has stood by him.
Yes, and nobody wants Ray Rice.
Yeah, no, and he was good. I mean, he was a good running back. And it's amazing how being really good as an athlete, how much forgiveness that often gives you from a public perception standpoint. He was an incredible running back. He's never going to play in the NFL again. I really doubt Josh Brown will ever play in the NFL again. And we had video of Ray Rice cold cocking his girlfriend. He completely knocked her unconscious.
You know,
we've got kind of these weird, vague stories of abuse regarding Josh Brown. No criminal charges. Nobody's ever discussed. I mean, he himself said in his statement, "I have never struck my wife."
But he did say abuse takes different forms than just hitting
somebody.
It
does. I'm curious to, I got to be honest with you, I'm curious to know what the abuse was.
Well, it'd be interesting because he said it started when he was young. He was sexually abused as a child. He got addicted to porn. So it's interesting when you first,
and that's one of those things where I'd be the first to admit abuse does not have to take the form of physical abuse. And that's what I wonder is what's going on here. Yeah. If this was some type of sexual or emotional, mental abuse. Yeah. On the flip side, and I'm kind of mulling this over in my head. Kudos to the NFL for saying, hey, okay, you know, we didn't know exactly what was going on. And I know you said you don't like those stance, but maybe it's a case of where the NFL is saying, listen, we didn't know what was going on. It took us a while to kind of piece it together. Now we've got a feeling for what happened, and now we're going to take action now that we know actually what the hell happened.
Well, yes and no, because, Roger Goodell, who I don't like. I don't like the NFL commissioner.
You know, I think he gets a bad rap because keep in mind, there have been more strides in terms of, now he hasn't been the guy who's just said, yeah, that's right, this is wrong, let's do it this way now and completely about faced it. But you have seen more change in the way the NFL has handled issues under Goodell than you have seen under almost any other commissioner in its past. I mean, think about it. It used to be a player could just beat their spouse to a bloody pulp, and it was purely a case of, well, we're going to let the legal system and the courts handle it, and the NFL wouldn't touch it all, and that player would keep playing for whatever team they were on.
Yeah.
I mean, think back to, crime in general. I mean, think back to the Dallas Cowboys in the early 90s and Michael Irvin getting pulled over by the police, toked up on coke, coming from the White House and telling, like, don't you know who I am? He's in the Hall of Fame now. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think in this day and age, he would have gotten dumped from that team so freaking fast. The drug enforcement policy, Josh Gordon with the Cleveland Browns. I mean, you've got all of these players that from a disciplinary standpoint, has it been rapid, swift, decisive change? No. But it's also been more change than the NFL has ever had.
But I guess what I'm getting at, when Roger Goodell talks about it, when it finally comes out, he goes, well, we didn't get cooperation from the King County Sheriff's Department in Washington. The King County Sheriff's Department goes, no, that's not true. You had a guy call us that didn't identify himself, says, hey, my name is blank blank, and here's my email address. It was like a Gmail account. He didn't identify himself with the National Football League investigating and why they were investigating. So you throw somebody under the bus, but yet you don't. Your own investigators don't even know how to do an investigation. The information was right there. And King County said, we're not going to share that with anybody. If we would have known it was the National Football League and what they were doing, we would have shared that. But you had one of your guys call up and say, I'm such and such. I need the information on Josh Brown. They're like, no. Then he requests by email, and it's like a Gmail account. Well, no, we're not going to do that. So, I mean, you don't throw people under the bus for your own miss.
And the way they've handled these situations has not been the best.
Same with Ray Rice.
And then that was horrible because that was, what did they do? They did like a 2-game suspension, then a 4-game, and then suspended him for the year.
Yes.
It was one of these, and I see your point here. The overall change, I think, is good. The way they've handled specific situations has been kind of a...
Well, Ray Rice is double jeopardy. Josh Brown is double jeopardy.
It is. Let's find out what the media knows. And if the media doesn't know such and such information, then we're going to kind of let it slide.
Yes.
And I will give you that did happen, because with Ray Rice, they did the 4-game suspension when he admitted to... striking his wife.
And the video pulling her out of the...
And then when the video came out, then it was one of those, okay, we suspended him, we punished him, and this is kind of the punishment we've given everybody in the past for domestic violence issues. But now there's a video, and the public perception is really bad. Now we need to extend... Yeah. Because of perception's sake, now we need to extend it.
Yeah.
You make a good point in that regard. The specific instances, the change has come. The specific dealings with stuff has been wildly inconsistent. And I will say, it has been based solely on media and public perception in terms of how they've handled a lot of this stuff. But that being said, these are handlings that wouldn't have even come to the NFL 20 years ago.
When you first heard it, what was your thought?
Extreme disappointment. I mean, now, here's the thing. Personally, I don't know Josh Brown at all. Never met the guy. You hate to see this happen in any setting, in any form, no matter what type the abuse is.
How do you think your former team, the Giants, handled it? Because they've come out and said, oh, we knew about this. Josh told us that he did this stuff. They flat out said, yeah, we knew about this. That's why his teammates were trying to back him, saying, Josh has been forthcoming with us. We knew that. We've known this for a while. And the Giants didn't do anything.
It's hard for me to answer that, because I got to be honest with you. Again, stating that, I know abuse can take many different forms. I've got no idea what he did.
Nobody
does. And that's the thing that makes me wonder. It's one of those, well, is this one of these things like this guy's... I mean, he's really big into goat porn, and if this hits the media, it's going to be a public relations disaster.
Do they make goat porn?
I have no idea. I'm throwing it out there as a for instance.
Are you a Pornhub or are you a porn type guy?
You're killing me, dude.
I'm serious.
You're killing me.
I did this on my radio show. I didn't know even Pornhub existed till the other day. I've seen the U-Porn because it's free, but Pornhub is not bad. Just saying. You're looking at me like you're just disgusted.
Aren't you married?
I am.
This is a family show.
But I'm not addicted to it. There's
you can quit anytime you want, right?
Am I just digging my grave?
You're sitting there going like, I can quit anytime I want.
Yeah, usually after about...
I don't have a problem.
I usually quit right about minute 10, minute 20 seconds in. Would you laugh at that?
We all know how long Travis lasts now.
By myself. Anyway.
Only you know how you like it the best.
That's right. See? You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, my God. We are all going to hell in a flaming hand.
Those of you that have made it 40 minutes into this podcast.
Drinking beer the whole way. Bottom line on Josh Brown. Highly disappointed. As a guy, highly disappointed. Never struck a woman in my life. Don't plan to. Part of me, though, is sitting here going like, The vagary of it just has me sitting here going like, well, what did he do?
Yeah, I think that has a lot of people. When you don't know exactly what he did, then
it, I mean, is he like Tiger Woods, where he's like addicted to sex and has sex with?
Did you see Tiger said told Charlie Rose he didn't regret cheating on his wife? The only thing he regretted was not going back to Stanford for another year. Charlie Rose says, "Do you have any regrets?" Yeah, I didn't go back to Stanford for another year. Not cheating on your wife? No. I regret that I had to go back to Stanford for another year.
The guy, at least he's honest.
Yes,
I guess.
Exactly.
Well,
I've left you speechless twice
today. I'm just saying, just don't get, if that's the case for Tiger, just dude, don't get married in the first place.
I don't think he ever will again.
Yeah, just, you know what? I mean, if that's your bag, fine, knock your socks off. Just don't get married and tie yourself down. Anyway, back to Josh Brown, though. And it's hard to put the level of disappointment and that kind of disappointment. It's almost a sadness.
Yeah, it is sad.
Being able to put it into words. And it's sad on multiple levels. For him, his family, his relationship with his wife, his football career. The guy was an incredibly, incredibly talented football player.
And very charismatic, very nice, personable.
And, you know, when you said that, because like I said, I've never met the guy.
Yeah.
It's amazing the number of reporters that I've seen, and mostly I'm talking Instagram and Twitter, who have put out their commentary along the lines of, hey, I've known this guy for a bunch of years, interviewed him X number of times, and has always talked about how, A, incredibly nice, how gracious he is with the media, and that there are few people who were, you even said it, could give you a better quote about any aspect of the game than Josh Brown could. And we will probably, I mean, he will probably never play football again. I could be wrong, but I doubt he'll ever play football again. I guess my final judgment is kind of one of those, I'd like to know what he did.
With that, I think we should stop while we are somewhat ahead.
Oh, God, we're 6 feet deep. we are nowhere near ahead. We have not put the shovels down.
Follow Dr. Rob Zadiska on Twitter at DocTalkSports, at DocTalkSports. He's been pretty active during the games. You're going to like his commentary. Somebody asked you earlier this week, Matt Verzel, former Husker, said, hey, Doc.
Do you need two kidneys?
Yes, because he wants to give one up to go to the Cubs World Series games.
And I'm not a Cubs guy. Just don't get it at all. I don't understand it.
Follow him at Doc Talk Sports. Give us a like here on Podbean. Please give us a review on iTunes. Huskers at Wisconsin this weekend. We'll have a full wrap-up next week and talk about what's ahead for Nebraska moving on in the West Division, in the Big Ten, and on into the postseason. For Dr. Rob Zadiska, I'm Travis Justice. We'll talk to you next week on the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy.